Good evening. This is Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and we are in the midst, actually we're 141 pages into Secret Talks Volume 5 by E.J. Gold, and that volume, which has never been released as a public
commercial,
that Secret Talks is called Work of Groups. And it's couple hundred pages long, and it is a demonstration of groups working with EJ. Fascinating, both how they work with him and how he works with them. Basically, what EJ does is he has something. It's a dinner. It's an event. It's a something, and he speaks, and then he's done. And then the group gets together. And puts together the talk. They reconstruct it from notes.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, if we only had a scribe, we could do the same thing.
Fortunately for us.
Yes, Ivan?
We had a scribe last week.
We did. Oh, my God. So.
Yes.
And I want to make a note also that Paula, our dear Paula, has also spent a great deal of time putting all of these notes into electronic form so I can begin reviewing them. And I had it on my calendar to start reviewing them this morning. My calendar, pardon?
Too bad you didn't.
I have an electronic calendar, and I just put my cursor on it and I moved it 2 days from now. It was real easy.
You call that time travel? Or
I call it time travel.
Yeah, that sounds like time travel to me.
But because we're here tonight, also what our scribe does is annotate from the talk the content pulled from the meeting that are relates to groupness. What are the elements of a group? And so this week I think you have quite a number of notes.
Yes,
a lot of observations.
Okay,
and
good.
We're going to start the class by reading the notes from last week's class. And Ivan, take it away.
All right. And yeah, just a warning to the listeners that this is 3 pages of minutes here. Wednesday, 10, 11, 17, work of groups, number 30. Roman number 1, operations of a group. 1, listening to something being read brings more to what is said, which is reminiscent of the title of the original Tibetan Book of the Dead, The Great Liberation Upon Hearing in the Bardo Todal. 2, this type of sharing in a group while doing the proposed exercise, if you met a newbie, what practical exercise would you give to that person? We are putting sticks on the fire, and that's growing the fire for all of us. It provides warmth for all of us. 3, the more experienced group members create a safe space for people to share in. 4, all voices are interesting in the group work we do, and it weaves a pattern that is very nice for us. 5, members may offer their strengths toward the success of the group. 6, starts out with a quote from the talk, knowing how to work must be practical. Think of it as a hands-on process. Once you reach a plateau, with a given exercise, is there a word missing there? Excuse me. With a given exercise,
I think I know what it
is. And you've gone on, then you can now train a novice with what you had been given.
When you reach a certain point or level.
Okay.
I mean, that was the concept.
Yeah.
Here. Just note it.
once you reach a plateau, a certain point, let's say, with a given exercise, and you've gone on, then you can now train a novice with what you had been given. The example given was how it worked in the Wood Shillow training. Roman numeral 2, observations of being in a group. 1, we are ambassadors for the work. There's something about, quote, these ambassadors, unquote, in this group that's different from many other groups. There's a sense of true humility that gives a forum in which to share. You know how much you don't know. You carry that with you and stand on it. But then offer, here's what I know. 2, you're running your inner practice and your outer practice like a Mobius strip. You don't lose the strand of your internal observation as you make a suggestion, comment, or smile, which allows another being to be present if they so choose. 3, hospitality has to do with recognizing others, actually paying attention to others. That's a gift to them. We don't have to be afraid. People are afraid. By recognizing them as a human being for a moment, they don't have to be afraid. They can just be with you, and there's a sense of presence, and they can be in that with you. That's what we had.
That's impressive.
This material, that we're working on here. First of all, the platform, which is this volume, Secret Talks volume here, Ivan, is so rich.
And, it is.
And what we're getting from it, and Philbert Dale, you're a resident scholar, academician. I mean, the stuff we're talking about is quite unique, right?
Oh, yes, unquestionably.
I've been around a lot. I've gone to a lot of different groups, studied with a lot of different forums. No one that I know of is talking in this level of granularity about work on self. And it's work on self that will set us free.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that having read through those entire notes, I mean, what it reminded me from about last week was that all of those ideas and comments and all of those suggestions were generated from talking about this request or this assignment. What was one thing that you would come up with to say to a newbie, stranger, a novice, a complete novice to these ideas? What would you present to that person?
And I think we may have had 15 different responses on that. All of them unique, all of them fresh. And if I remember correctly, I remember listening. No two were alike.
There was a lot of
variation. Originality, and it sparked from the person's personal interest. Just fascinating.
I thought that is an interesting demonstration. I thought it goes along with the core idea there about being practical, which is to say, what I can present to somebody is what I know, and I'm not gonna energize them. I'm not gonna attract them or excite them if I'm just speculating about something or saying, well, gee, people in the work, you know, may be able to walk on water or something, you know, but I don't know anything about that. So what's the use of talking about it?
I had a meeting this morning with a friend who's associated with us here, and we were talking about the concept of humility. It may be, in fact, it is true that in a certain way, and I can go into it in detail, but in a certain way, we do know more about spiritual work than a lot of people. Okay? But it doesn't matter, because the distance we have yet, that each of us have yet to travel is so huge that by, if you actually understand that point of how much work do you have to do on yourself, then you're humbled by that effort, no matter how much you learn.
You know, David, also, I couldn't help but note last weekend and in listening to these notes being reread tonight, yet another example of work of groups, which is to say, coming together as a group, we're like a single collective mind. So in the same way that we might carry on an inner dialogue with ourselves about a particular situation, do I want to go left, do I want to go right, am I going in the right direction? You know, we find three or four or several personalities within ourselves discussing any particular issue or several issues, several entirely different issues all at once. You know, do I need an umbrella? Is my car tank filled up with gas for the trip I'm about to take? Well, as we gather together as a group, it's almost as though there's one mind which is speaking to itself. Well, what are the different ways that I can share my sense of self-remembering with others, you know, that kind of thing.
One thing, in a sense, Ivan, and that's what Silverdale's telling us, we're one thing here, and different parts of us are speaking out. Mm-hmm. I am the angelic. How many people are online, Dan? So there's 9 individuals, and there's 6 people here.
6 of us here, yeah.
I don't know why I have so much trouble with simple math in this space. I mean, it doesn't matter whether I'm accounting.
Fortunately, you don't have to work with numbers, right?
Ever, thank God. I'll leave that to those who are able. And so that's 15 people or so, all of which is one group. It constitutes one group because there's a common intentionality. And our intention is to come together with the best we have in mind, and we bring that to each other. We lay it on the table and say, here's what I brought for the potluck tonight. You know, here's the dish I brought. And we share that with each other, and that therefore makes a fine meal, and we're going to do it again tonight. Okay? So we have a nice, the next several chapters are all very, very, very short. I don't know if you had a chance to look at any of them, but we're going to read the next two, and you're going to see how connected the thought patterns are. So where we are now is we're on chapter 56, and we're on page 141, and this chapter is only, it's a page long, fundamentally. And do you want to get us started, or how do you want to do it, Ivan?
I can read it.
Go ahead and get it. Go ahead and read it.
Chapter 56. Notes on a Dinner Talk. At dinner, G gave us some real mash corn whiskey and made us gulp it down with him and laughed with us at our expressions, observing our idiotism, mood changes afterward. He pointed out how moods are subject to minor changes in body chemistry. A special dinner could be feeding of data. It's in quotes, feeding of data. When raw, it is called data. When it actually becomes part of our essence, we can call it understanding. When received, understood, and accepted. Corn mash could be a distillation, a variety of manifestations according to type.
Let's just pause there for a moment. So I want to point out, and I pointed this out, these are two different types of knowledge, right? There's just data,
mm-hmm.
just data. And then there's understanding. So what constitutes understanding? What brings data to the form of understanding? Silverdale, do you mind if I put you on the spot for that question?
Not at all. I like the way that Gurdjieff defines it. Understanding is the product or the blending of data intentionally acquired together with personal experiences, personally experienced. That is data that has been personally verified in one's own incontestable experience. Those two together produce understanding, because you now have the essence that sense, feels, and perceives the truthfulness of whatever data it is considering. So typically you have to gather a lot of data before you can begin to reduce it to personal experience. Just, you know, it takes time to figure out what you're trying to understand intellectually. Once you convert it to personal experience, you're now, the essence is, our essential self is then beginning to personally experience this formerly dry data, and then that combination produces the understanding that is being referred to here.
So work in group is like a practicum. Okay?
Yes.
We have data available to us. We have data available to us, and then when we come together, we put the data to practice. For instance, let's say you're going through a very difficult time in your life. Okay, let's just say some really hard for you right now, Ivan, and things are tough. Well, as you have an unusual opportunity. You do, because you can ask for help from the group. You can, the group has a pliability such that if you throw something into the group, you can get assistance back. If you are in a difficult situation, that's a practicum for practicing things like, name anything you can think of right now from any of the phrases in the work. Not making any sudden moves, right? Now I am experiencing the clear light. I don't know where I'm headed, but I'm headed in the right direction. Something like that. So you bring those tools, have those tools in your back pocket, and when things happen, you bring them out and you test them. And after a while, you go, darn, that really works. It really bloody works. That's when it starts to become understanding, and it goes to that next level of knowledge.
Yeah, well, then also it could be a process of trial and error, but this is what, what Silverdale said is the experiences, personal experiences, personally experienced.
That's right.
So, you know, it's not going to be just like one rising path all the time, you know, smooth and ascending and so on. It's at least, I guess I can only talk from my experience, but it's highly unlikely to be all positive or all successful or all
immaterial.
Yeah,
it's immaterial.
It's an experiment.
Data gathering.
Yeah, because it's an experiment that I'm conducting on myself or with myself, using myself, let's say. So, you know, you get all kinds of experimental results, and you have to sort them out.
David, I want to add something.
Oh, there's Harry.
Go ahead, Harry, please.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Ivan.
No, please.
I mean, we had this discussion in our Austin group, and someone in the group mentioned that 67% of the population claims to have had a spiritual experience. So we brought that up, and I said, well, does that mean, since we brought it up in that way from a distance, that we're in the 33%? had one. It's considerably different to actually have one than to talk about it and how it's distributed between different socioeconomic classes, for example, which is where the conversation was going.
In the first chapter of Moby Dick, Melville is talking about his main character, Ishmael. And Ishmael is saying, I get nervous and all this, and when all this happens, I got to go to sea. Mm-hmm. And then he talks about people, how they love to go near the water, or see a fountain, or see a river, or go see the lake.
Okay.
And there's a phrase where he says, and then they stand on the shore looking out to the sea, longing, but they don't go to sea. We look out, our heart wants to travel into that area of spiritual experiences. But we sometimes settle for other people telling us what that's like. We settle for other people rather than we ourselves directly experience, because we don't think we're capable of it. We don't think that we're worthy of a spiritual experience. Oh my gosh, that's possibly. Yet we have one every week when the group forms. And if your intentionality comes from a proper place, there you go.
I can't resist bringing in, since you broke into literature with Mr. Melville, in response to what Harry's saying, sort of bring something in from another field, which is there was a poet, there was a great German poet, his name was Rainer Maria Rilke.
Yep.
And he wrote, interestingly enough, he wrote really unusual and magnificent poetry, and even in, I can't read German, unfortunately, but even in translation, I can tell that it's magnificent poetry, even though a lot is lost. But he's quite famous for a little tiny book that he wrote that's been translated, and there are many, many editions of it, and it's been circulating for years, called Letters to a Young Poet. And he wrote these letters. A young man sent him a sheaf of amateur work, basically novice, beginning work. The man was in his early 20s, I think. And Rilke responded quite warmly, we could say with hospitality. He was very, very encouraging to this young man, and he wrote him these wonderful letters. And he says, in one of those letters, there's one of my favorite passages in there. He says, he's writing to this young man and saying, well, don't try. Basically saying, you don't have to write about ultimate realities, about justice or about the great truth or about seeing the light at the end of the tunnel or something like that. Everybody in this life, every individual, every single person who would want to write or want to do any kind of art, actually, has a tremendous treasure trove of material to work with, and that is your childhood, the memories of your childhood that you can go into.
Wow.
And I think that this is, I've never forgotten that passage, and I just sometimes quote it. I pull it out, put it in journals and things like that. And, he's saying that actually, 100% of people have probably had a spiritual experience.
I agree.
And it's part of this, let's say, possibly buried, covered over, or forgotten, or certainly undervalued memories, store of memories from childhood. And, there again, this is in the terms of the initiation, like what everyone brings to a group like ours, and what we could offer to a newbie, like what I've experienced, the fact that I'm here, that I had this childhood of mine, and that's how I started out, and I have these childhood memories. And there are markers in there, and my childhood memories, there are markers that have led me here to this moment now.
Absolutely.
And I think I would say it's true of everybody. Just like Rilke said, to any young man, to anybody who wants to go into the imagination or to do works of art, you have this treasure. You don't have to be a hero. You don't have to be a celebrity. You don't have to be a jump out of planes or climb Mount Everest.
We have that.
You have a resource.
Dan, let's type the name. This is a very short document. All right, I have a copy of it. Let's type that into the chat and let's write it down. It's Rainier Marie.
Yeah, R-A-I-N-E-R. And his middle name, I guess, or family name, M-A-R-I-A, Rilke, R-I-L-K-E. And it's called Letters to a Young Poet.
It's worth reading. It's very short.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's so gracious. You know, it's
actually,
so great.
It's a perfect, a wonderful example of hospitality. You know, of a welcoming attitude towards somebody that he didn't have to answer. He didn't even have to answer the letters from this young man. I mean, you know, there was no reason nobody was forcing him to answer.
We won't go down the road of literature because that's popping in my head right now. Baudelaire and a couple of other things.
Well, anyway, it just strikes me that, you know, anybody who says, let's say any one of us who says, well, boy, I don't know, what would I, you know, how could I have any authority? How could I say anything to a stranger or to a novice interested in these ideas? And see, the fact is that every one of us has had an initiation.
That's right. Here
because we had an initiation experience. And as mine, would you recognize my, I don't know if you'd recognize my initiation experience. I'd have to explain it to you, and you'd have to explain yours to me, and so on. They're all different. Like 27 people had 27 different, and you know, and this is remarkable. We've learned this at some of our institute, these conventions we used to have. We'd sit in a circle at the end of the convention, and we had one question. We asked everybody, how did you hear about these ideas? How did you get started on this path?
Fascinating.
And 27 people had 27 remarkably different stories about
how
they heard about these
fascinating
ideas.
Fascinating and different. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a kind of a cognition or an illumination that came just from hearing that many people from that many different backgrounds and walks of life and personality types and economic strata, you know, whatever, and they all had ended up in a room together at an IDHHB convention,
right.
But everybody somewhere, you know, everybody had some experience, touchstone, you know, had some key experience, some irresistible or unmistakable experience that woke you up, you know, that gave you this awakening that you have to go not the mechanical path,
right,
not the money, you know, not the two cars in the garage or, you know, the high earnings, that status of life or whatever it is. It's this path. And you end up, and this is what happens. What happens to these black sheep? They end up sitting in a circle at an IDHHB trying to figure out how they got there. So, anyway, that's all I have to say about that.
Go ahead,
thank you.
There is a comment from Bernie LaPlante. He says, it appears that humility in this work is more an instrument than a virtue, maybe better expressed instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
It is an instrument. It's a tool that you can take into any battle. It's very strong, actually, if you use it.
I think it's also... Again, if you spend time around EJ, and one of the things that you learn, and Harry, I'm going to go back to the 67%. I mean, there's no telling who is going to respond to the ideas. There's not, you know, I've been utterly shocked and astounded sometimes at seeing EJ interact with strangers, with people, because he'll go, it doesn't matter who it is, and it doesn't matter how unlikely or how impossible it might seem that they would be at all interested. You know, I've seen him, you know, he'll chat up somebody at a cash register or, you know, in a store or
but
chance meeting on
a street. But we all do
that.
We
yeah.
all do that and should do that.
Yeah, I'm just saying that
that's the ambassadorship that we talked about
yeah,
last week.
Yeah, but you never know where the seed is going to take hold or where you're going to get the response.
So our job is to get out there and speak it, to sing the song of what we're learning. and I think we are able to do that. Let's continue on a little bit. If you want to continue to
you
read,
wanna,
then
do you want to read
go ahead.
Or let somebody else? I should read.
Yeah, just
on the bottom of still on 141. Our mood, body chemistry, to which mood is subject. Result of digestion of corn whiskey is moving, voluntary, and instinctive, involuntary centers. So there sounds like they, this is probably a distillation, so to speak. These are a few notes from probably a much longer talk about these manifestations.
Correct.
That people had after getting loaded with corn liquor. Top of 142. Mash is a product we ordinarily feed to animals. Pigs eat mash and get fat. Then humans eat the pigs. Reciprocal feeding. Any comment on that?
No.
We do not have, sounds like a joke to me. We do not have resistance to music as to other impressions. It is easier for some music to reach essence and become understanding. Minor key produces changes of mood, dramatic effect, while major key is food for thought. Mash is corn, pure corn, corny. Whiskey is for wishing.
I think the most important thing to take away is this concept of mood. Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes the mood is what allows certain data to get into certain places, too.
Yeah.
And let it settle in a particular place. But I want to go on to just the next paragraph, the next chapter, okay?
Yeah.
Once again, it's just a couple of pages. And let's get started on that.
Chapter
again, okay?
7?
Yeah. Chapter 57, Receptivity. G waits until the worst possible times to transmit real data. It takes in the cellular, if we are sufficiently vulnerable to exhaustion, irritation, mood, only special data is eligible for this special treatment. Everyone in the group had been doing quite a great deal of hard work. We cleaned up and prepared for the meeting. G entered and sat down. G, M, you falling asleep? M, yes, I'm very tired. G, you wait for this meeting all day and now you wish to sleep? M, yes, I'm afraid so. You see, we have all worked very hard. When egg tell chicken. I know you work hard. You still must be only half baked. You like a horse ready for the glue factory before we begin. Vulnerable in cells for very special data. Examples, digging ditches, quilting bee, two sets of conditions. G can transmit one type of data in one, another type in another. Let's stop there for a moment. We're going to get back to a story that Ivan told us a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-oh.
But I remember in the days when I first came here, when we first were here, having these spectacular talks. We'd have a dinner, and then we'd go into a talk, and sometimes we'd be in the atrium around those little jewelry tables, benches, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it'd
yeah,
be
right.
Packed like crazy. Because, I don't know, 30 people would be in there. And it would be hot. It's late at night. And EJ would be sometimes sitting there talking. I remember one time he was there talking. how he could continue to talk just for hours. And I remember one night, Tommy was sitting right next to EJ. Tommy, many of you don't know him. He's passed away. But Tommy was a very tall, elegant, blonde artist guy. Striking character.
Flamboyant, I would say.
Very flamboyant. So he's sitting next to EJ, and he is just falling asleep. So EJ's talking away, and every few minutes, Tommy's head would fall forward, like falling asleep, right? He's sitting there and he'd just fall asleep. His head would come within inches of the table, and then he'd jerk back up.
Yeah.
EJ never commented on that. He just kept talking. And then yeah. Tommy said, I remember one night, there's a test in split attention, Marvette is telling us. So one night I'm sitting there, and it's midnight plus or something, and it was hot, and I was fairly new, and I'm sitting in the corner somehow, and there's like tons of people. We're in the atrium, and EJ's standing in the doorway to the atrium looking on. He's going on and on and on, and I'm sitting there about to pass out, and then he goes, "Right, David?" That'll wake you up. So we get into these situations like that, and then do you remember the talk, what was it, like the incense talk or incense and some darn thing, colors and color
and radiation.
You weren't there for that. So this was, we had had the video equipment now for a while, and I was pretty good at it, actually. And we had this switcher and all of this. And this was another one that was just, it went on for at least 30 hours, I'm sure of it, or three or four, I don't know, one of the two. And it was quite interesting to watch, because EJ was going on and on and on like this about it. And people would start fall asleep mm-hmm. on the floor. They'd be asleep on the floor, and people would just go wham, 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 and they'd be asleep. And there were and EJ never commented on it, slowed down, or anything. He would just keep talking on this radiation, color and radiation. And the lights, we had different. Were you there that night?
I believe I was. I remember, and I can't remember whether I fell asleep or not. I probably did, but I know it was really clear that this.
Ivan fell asleep early on.
Yeah, I probably fell asleep quite early, but this is it's a really good example of this what these talks here are about, because he was conveying data to someone, but you know all those who were falling asleep were not. Obviously, the data was not for them.
So. I asked them about it later in another day when we weren't in the intensity of that radiation. And there was another way to look at the talk altogether, mm-hmm. and that was the intensity of the radiation kept growing, mm-hmm. and it got hotter and hotter and hotter. Not maybe physically hotter, I don't remember, but it got hotter and hotter, and as the radiation became more, some people left the space. How do you leave a space when you're right there? You just fall asleep. And then you're no longer in that space, are you? I had an external requirement of I had to run the cameras and the switcher, I probably would have fallen asleep too. But it was interesting to see who left the space, not personally. I mean, it wasn't like mm-hmm. Mary left and John left. It was interesting to watch the phenomena of the of the power of that mood and how people left in the only way they were able to do it. They couldn't. I remember, do you remember this? Were you there for the Seymour talk?
No, that one I was not.
Yeah,
no,
that was a very similar thing. Yeah. There's a talk of the month on that.
Right, yeah, that's quite a good.
There are videos on the color and radiation DVDs. They used to be videos.
I think the similar talk is also in, is it Life in the Labyrinth? It's in one of those books.
Mentioned in there.
I think it is. I think the whole talk is edited. It's in an edited form, but it's a chapter. It's a chapter in there.
But that was a space that was very intense. And
yeah, those experiences. Well, I mean, it's an experience that's personally experienced by everybody present, but the data, you know, whatever the data is, you know, is not necessarily for everybody present. That's what I got out of it.
You weren't there either. Go ahead, Martha.
Well, to bring it more to present time, just a year ago in July, Claudio Naranjo was here visiting. We had a workshop. And so he was just here visiting for one day, but of course EJ had him invited so that he could participate. And he had also brought some guests from Portugal. And EJ had met them before the afternoon session, which this was the workshop. He had chatted with them in the cafe when everybody had lunch. And so he knew this one woman wanted to start a gallery. And she had a little kind of toddler with her and her partner. And so we assembled back into the barn for the afternoon session. And he and Claudio arrived a few minutes late, and they sat down. And he proceeded to continue with his talk, which he had very briefly started before lunch. But it was so potent. It was just really, really potent. And I was on camera. I don't know that Oz was here. At least he wasn't here for the afternoon session. And it's always the way, well, it's not always, but often the way for these potent things, I mean, at least the cameras were on, and the recordings were on, but, you know, there's always some fluke of something that goes wrong. It could have been better, which I didn't notice until the very end. But it was such a potent talk, and lots of people, they just kind of were on the fringe of it, but the person that I thought it was directed to really was just right there with just full attention, because that person probably will never, you know, cross our path again.
Absolutely.
And he really must have, in my perception, perceived a certain necessity that she could really do something by opening this gallery. And it was really about getting in the flow, and that being in the work was getting in the flow. And that was like a primary principle of what you needed to activate and set up as your situation for being in the work. That's what I would say was just such the key element that could take you a long way. But it was just potent.
Margaret,
is that
video archive available in the same way that tonight's session is available if somebody wanted to go back and look at it? Okay.
Margaret's shaking her head saying no.
Okay, thanks.
Talk. The Claudio one?
Yes.
She's saying it will be released on DVD.
Yeah, I think it's
I'd like to watch that.
It's about
2 hours. 2 hours,
yeah.
And you'll inform us. Let us know, including Silverdale, when that. Okay? Thank you. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, Bernie says, could some beta penetrate better when the beta is asleep?
when the beta is asleep. I'm not exactly sure, I guess.
I don't know for sure, but I don't think putting the beta, you know, blocking the beta, as they call it, I don't think that requires putting the organism to sleep.
Yeah, he's not. I don't know that he's implying that. It's just that where the machine isn't superior, the ego of the machine isn't operable, then things are possible, and maybe that's what he's implying.
Yeah, actually,
that makes sense.
Yeah, I think Marvette. Yeah, and also Marvette was just describing that situation where that individual, you know, who was receiving that data from EJ, that individual was vibrating at a different frequency.
They had a certain
event.
She had a necessity, and she and EJ responded to the necessity. So given this experiment that we've had in many, many cases where sometimes the radiation is too much, we drop out, you don't hear things, What made me think about when I was thinking about it the other day was, is your sensing mechanism tuned well enough that when important data arise, you click into it? Does that make sense?
Yes.
You got it?
Say what you think.
What you said was, is your sensing mechanism tuned well enough to click into that kind of data? And I would say sensing mechanism is a good term, but I would also say that it has to do with the quality of attention. And that if you're holding, and from my understanding of things, how I view the world, I would say if your attention is held on a certain caliber of work intention, and so that you're looking at life through the filter of trying to be able to work, your attention is vibrating at a certain level, so that when a transmission comes in, it's not even a conscious thing necessarily. Your attention will kind of find its way there. If it really vibrates with what you are holding. In fact, you can be called to that chamber without even knowing why you're called, and then you find yourself there and you go, oh, yeah, I know why I'm here.
I just simply call that my sensing mechanism. Okay, of course it's attention. Are you paying attention? But your attention is vibrant, and in a sense it's waiting. There's a kind of waiting for that kernel to occur. I'm going to share one more quick experience, and this was a long, long time ago again, when the dining room was where the kitchen is now. Remember that, Ivan?
Vaguely.
It was where the kitchen is now. That we used to have meals there.
It was before 87.
It was right around that time. And lunch was going on, and it was just kind of like a quiet conversation among the group. And there was a certain energetic that came through. My head popped up. And at the exact same moment, EJ and Barbara's head clicked up too. It's like others saw it too. Can we be aware when we go throughout our day, we don't know when a saint is going to talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know when we're entering a chamber, as Marvette is telling us, because there's work we need to do there. We don't know. But are you light on your feet and ready for that? Paula, please.
In my experience, one of the things is in order to get there, moral and expectations, I need to put them on the side. Because as long as I expecting a specific outcome, I won't see it. Or if I get attached into ideas or good, bad, and this is like sometimes people confuse a spiritual with being moralist. And to me, that's completely different. And many times, actually, what happens is that it is kind of immoral in a way. And but yeah, those two things for me are important.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ivan.
Well, I was just going to say that this is formulation. In this particular chapter, where is it? He talked about feeding of data.
That was in the previous chapter.
Oh, it was in the previous chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is...
they kind of go together, the two chapters.
Yeah. A special dinner could be feeding of data. Okay, he says this is on page 141. It was in the notes on a dinner talk. So, Marvette, is that not what you were describing in with Claudio, with this, with that particular woman? In other words, there's data. It may not be for everybody who's present, but I just, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, you're right.
You know, in other words, there's this, the conditions. There are conditions that lend themselves to the transmission of data, and then that's not understanding. The understanding is up to that individual. The data was given.
Well,
the data is received.
I think that the understanding will come if that individual uses the data.
You have to make it alive.
And manifest it in her gallery,
yeah.
And says,
yeah.
Aha.
But there's also, I just want to bring up, it seemed like an ideal
moment.
Yeah, ideal moment to bring up that saying that EJ used to repeat quite often years ago, which is to buy in haste and you sell at leisure. To buy in haste, he used it as a analogy. It was like a metaphor, an analogy for taking in data when data was available. In other words, he was telling, he was using that formulation because it was with a couple from Massachusetts. The man who was a very successful businessman.
Yeah.
Felt Company.
Steven
Sidney, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he actually was giving, especially Steve and Sidney, this formulation, which is to say, you just don't hesitate to take and take it. You buy, use your resources, use your attention, use your energy, use your life, the resources or whatever, the aliveness that you have in your life to absorb and absorb and absorb and absorb data. And then the fact is that you may be using that data, you know, being able to sell again, in other words, being able to convert it into something that you now can use, which is like the understanding part, that may take years and years and years. But, you know, he was basically telling them, he was telling whole groups of people, you know, to be open to receiving what was available.
Right.
When the transmission was present, be open to it. Because, and then, you know, this has certainly been my experience. I mean, some of those things like that color and radiation
mm-hmm.
talk, and there are, again, you have experiences like that. You have downloads. You have there are radiations. You know, we absorb radiations. Let's say years ago, the result of that, the understanding of it, may come after years. It may come in some other completely different situation. The converting of that data into understanding may not be in
Please.
A very fast process.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that the data is not all information. I mean, the words are not the full transmission.
Right.
They're a means of exchange, but there's far more transmission than just the words.
And that's why last week we talked about this idea of the importance of hearing from each other. You hear, and you get so much more data when you're doing that. And I guess what I wanted to say is that when you go out into the world tomorrow, we are voyagers. We are voyagers. When you go out into the world as a voyager, find out what message is being transmitted to you. There will be something, it'll be even tomorrow, will be said to you, or you will overhear, or you'll read somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be exactly at the right moment, and you'll get it. So that's what this chapter was saying to me of receptivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we be open to the message that's coming through to us? I think we can. So it's not so much that I go with preconceived expectations, but I do go forward with expectation. Like, I'm watching around. Pardon?
You're using the word expectation.
Correct, I am. Yeah, I'm not. It's a sense of wonder. It's fundamental to.
There you go.
I never know what I'm going to stumble on. And that's okay with me. How are you doing over there, Dan?
Well, Bernie just followed up on his earlier question by asking, like, could some data penetrate better when the beta is asleep, giving a chance to lesser stimuli?
Yeah. Think of it in terms, Bernie, of the natural ego of your machine, like Paola was saying, is that if we can suspend our expectations and our human biological machine's mechanicalness, if we can suspend that for a moment, that other data will come to you. But in order to suspend it, you have to know a little bit about yourself. In order to know a little bit about yourself, you need to observe yourself. Not judge yourself, but observe yourself. What is this guy like? What is this person? What are they like?
In the past, unmasking just this Saturday, and you can check the archives in live stream, we did a demonstration about this type of idea with the beta waves and how when you, but it was like a experience rather than going on and on into talk and ideas, we actually had an exercise. So I think if you, Bernie, want to take a look to it, it will be useful. We were talking about telepathy, which is in a way, I mean, as a tool for spiritual work. So framed from that perspective, I think the ideas that were talked there in the first 20 minutes or so of that video will add to this conversation here.
This was the transcendence.
The
unmasking. I'm sorry. It was the unmasking workshop on Saturday. And if you can go on the archives, you can see the work that they did. And telepathy is in the particular title of this one. And as we go further on, we'll talk more about telepathy, because I think it's a very important tool that we have available to us. Conscious or unconscious, it's there. Wow, big topic.
Yeah,
glad you brought it up.
That is a big topic.
Yeah. So thank you for coming tonight. We look forward to seeing you again next Wednesday at 7. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Silverdale, for
being
here. Okay, good night.